Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Network. Or radio.
Are you going to keep going?
No.
That was too good. That made me feel
good. Surprise.
Well, there's our host, Heidi Morales-Ryan, and I'm not the engineer. She's going to have to be the host and the engineer. Of course, on Fridays, we call the show How Music Changed. Or Heidi can quote anything she wants to. And we just started a new topic last week. We're covering the life and music of Billie Holiday. I am so looking forward to being able to do this series. I usually get excited about any one of these things when we go really deep. And it's really fun because I learn as I go, and it's awesome to share
it's
the
a
information.
Great
it's yeah, and this is something that I think is it's perfect timing in a way because I as I said last week, I mean, there's an awful lot of people that now that Billie's generation has passed on, the people that were there when she was there are no longer here to tell us about how great she was. All that's left is the music. So to go over this in depth and also to discuss it by letting Billie speak about it in her own words is great fun for me. So with part two, I mean, I can say this much. I mean, despite her harsh beginnings, which we certainly covered quite intensely for part one last week, Billie quickly fit in with some of New York City's finest musicians so easily that she made it seem and sound almost effortless to do so. The music came very easily to her, but the tough times, though, continued. Being a black woman, singing with a band of mostly white musicians, she quickly discovered that America was not prepared for the integration that she could have represented and that she did represent at times, and that she had to fight her way through to continue and hold on to her status as one of the most revered vocalists of the late 30s and continuing on as we go through time. Hopefully, this show will capture some of that feeling. Now, what I've been doing is rather than use my own words at all, I'm going to let Billie Holiday do the talking. She published a book called Lady Sings the Blues. It was an autobiography that was written with William Dufty. But what's great about it is that he kept the tone and really just the words of Billie. As
you really get a sense of her voice coming through when you read her, the words of this book.
I definitely hope so. Yeah.
Yes.
I know that I did. I kind of got chills. I was afraid that by my reading it, it might end up diluting it a little bit because after all, my voice is nothing at all like Billie Holiday's.
You could always do that voice that you do when you're imitating my voice. Just kidding.
You mean if I talk like this? that would.
No.
Doesn't that sound right? Doesn't that sound just like Heidi? Right? Come on. All right. So let's pick up where we left off then. With Billie Holiday and her own words. This is right now we are in the era of, let's say, late 1935, musically. She goes, people started coming back to hear me. Franchotone and his lovely mother used to come to every place I ever worked, from Pods and Jerry's to Dickie Wells. Mrs. Tone was crazy about me, and she loved Billie Haywood and Cliff Allen, who had a great act at the Basement Brownie at the Basement Brownies. At the Hacha, I met Ralph Cooper. He was a big shot who'd been in the movies already, and he used to tell Frank Schiffman, who ran the Lafayette Theater and the Apollo, who to hire. Ralph convinced Schiffman to come and watch me. When Schiffman asked Cooper what style I had, Cooper was stumped. You never heard singing so low, so lazy, with such a drawl, he told him. But he couldn't put any label on me. This, I figured, was the biggest compliment they could pay me. Before anybody could compare me with any other singers, they were comparing other singers to me. It ain't the blues, was all Cooper could tell him. I don't know what it is, but you got to hear her. So Schiffman came up, and after he heard me, he offered to put me on the bill at the Apollo for 50 a week. This was something in those days. Uptown, the Apollo was what the Palace was downtown. Now, unless it was the records of Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong I heard as a kid, I don't know of anybody who actually influenced my singing, then or now. I always wanted Bessie's big sound and Pop's feeling. Young kids always ask me what my style is derived from and how it evolved and all that. What can I tell them? If you find a tune and it's got something to do with you, you don't have to evolve anything. You just feel it. And when you sing it, other people can feel something too. With me, it's got nothing to do with working or arranging or rehearsing. Give me a song I can feel, and it's never work. There are a few songs I feel so much, I can't stand to sing them. But that's something else again. If I had to sing Doggy in the Window, that would actually be work. But singing songs like The Man I Love or Porgy is no more work than sitting down and eating Chinese roast duck. And I love roast duck. I've lived songs like that. When I sing them, I live them again. And I love them. So let's play a track from October of 1935. This is Teddy Wilson and his orchestra with the credits. The band is Roy Eldridge on trumpet, Benny Morton on trombone, Chew Berry on tenor sax, Teddy Wilson on piano, Dave Barber on guitar, John Kirby on bass, and Cozy Cole on drums. It's a heck of a band. With Billie Holiday singing, the song is called If You Were Mine. You might notice that music, the way that things were arranged then, were a bit different, very different than the way things would be done now. It was like a standard arrangement for a vocalist. You might have noticed last week, and certainly you're going to notice it this week, is that all the arrangements will start pretty much with the band running through the verse and one or two soloists playing off of the melody, where they would get the whole part of the song more or less already performed. Then the vocalist would sing through the same pattern, and then it would go back to the band to play it out to the ending. So it's the songs themselves might be 3 minutes, but that would mean that the Billie Holiday herself would maybe get about a minute and a half of vocals on the tunes. That's just the way that it was at this point in time. And that's how you just heard it on If You Were Mine. What's also interesting there, though, is not just like that awesome hot trumpet part that the song ended with, which was Roy Eldridge, but the way that Benny Morton on trombone was playing like solo riffs in back of Billie while she was singing. Very sophisticated version of that song, If You Were Mine. All right, back to Billie's words then. The morning I opened at the Apollo, I had been up all night singing at the Hacha and went directly from there to the theater. The show was scheduled to go on at 10 a.m., and by the time I was up, I had gone to the bathroom 18 times. Pigmeat Markham, the comedian, was on the same bill, and he saved my life. They were playing the introduction, and he was standing in the wings. At the last minute, I grabbed and told him to do something because I had to split for the bathroom again. "It's no bathroom for you, girl," Pigmeat said. "You're going on stage." He saw I was scared, so he just grabbed me and gave me a big old healthy shove. When I stopped, I was halfway across the stage. I got to the mic somehow and grabbed it. I had a cheap white satin dress on, and my knees were shaking so bad the people didn't know whether I was going to sing or dance. Every time I opened my mouth, they weren't sure. One little broad in the front row hollered out, "Look, she's dancing and singing at the same time." I opened with Bernie Hanigan's song, If the Moon Turns Green. By the time I went into The Man I Love, I was all right. Then the house broke up. There was nothing like an audience at the Apollo. They were wide awake early in the morning. They didn't ask me what my style was, who I was, how I had evolved, where I'd come from, who influenced me, or anything. They just broke the house up, and they kept right on doing it. I played the Apollo for the second week. This was one of the few times it happened there, if I do say so myself, and I damn well do. All right, we'll play one more track, another song. This is, again, with the band opening with several bars, a little bit more than a minute long, and then Billie starts singing after a short intro by Johnny Hodges. This is called, this is called These and That and Those. Not a famous song, but I think it's fairly beautiful. Thank you.
that nature gave to you. These two hearts are bold, and that's a hand to hold, and those two arms have room to spare, where we both can share these and that and those.
That's one of those songs that I'm very surprised isn't more well known. It's just so well put together, and Billy sounds so
sublime.
Great on it. These and That and Those is the name of that song. All right, now, from Billy's book, I'm going to flip to chapter 4, which is where we're at. And she looks back a little bit here. She goes, in the early 30s, when Mom and I started trying to kick and scratch out a living in Harlem, the world we live in was still one that white people made. But it had become a world they damn near never saw. Sure, some of them patronized the after-hours joints. They came to the Cotton Club, a place Negroes never saw inside unless they played music or did the shakes or shimmies. But these were just sideshows, especially set up for white folks to come and pay their money for kicks. These places weren't for real. The life we lived was. But it was all backstage, and damn few white folks ever got to see it. When they did, they may as well have dropped in from another planet. Everything about it seemed to be news to them. Play one more song. It's funny that I was just talking about how the songs are arranged in that manner, about the band will come in and play the full song for about a minute and a half, and the singer would come in and get their minute and a half before they ended it with a 30-second reprise. But this song actually plays with that. This is a song that's a little bit different. Billy starts singing pretty quickly after a little short intro by Johnny Hodges. This song is called You Let Me Down.
You told me that I was like an angel. Told me I would fit to wear a crown. So that you could get a thrill, you put me on a pedestal and then you let me down, let me down. You told me that I'd be wearing diamonds, I would have the smartest car in town. Made me think that I'm the top and then you let the ladder drop. You know you let me down, let me down. I walked upon a rainbow, I clung on to a star. You had me up in heaven, that's why I had to fall so far. I was even looking for a cottage, I was measured for a wedding gown. That's how I got cynical, you put me on a pinnacle, and then you let me down, let me down. How you let me down. Thank you.
have it. That's You Let Me Down. Now, the one thing about Billie, that she was very close with her mother, but I mean literally too, in terms of like age. They were much more like sisters than mother and daughter. And I'll let Billie explain that. I never got beyond the fifth grade in school, and they were Baltimore's broke down segregated schools at that. But I guess you could call that progress. Mom was only 13 years older than me and had never got to school at all. Imagine having a kid when you're 13. Anyway, in my time, the Board of Education didn't care enough about it to send some social worker chasing after me. But in Mom's time, they didn't care at all. One of the things we did together in those early Harlem days was hold classes. I was the teacher, Mom the pupil, and I taught her to read and write. Nothing I ever did gave me such a kick as getting a handwritten note from her later when I was on the road, or watching her fall out when she read a letter from Louis Armstrong signed, "Red Beans and Ricely Yours." Let's play one more song. This is a song that's actually was never released on vinyl, but she is actually in a short film called Symphony in Black. Symphony in Black, that was filmed at Paramount Studios in Astoria, Queens. And this is the very first time that Billie was in a film in her entire career. Very early, too, 1935. The song that she performs is called Saddest Tale, also known as Big City Blues. It's an odd one, but it's must have been very exciting for Billie Holiday, because the band that was there in Paramount Studios backing her up was none other than Duke Ellington and his orchestra. So pretty big deal for her at that point in time. All right, back to the book called Lady Sings the Blues. One day, I was taking Mom to the old Lafayette Theater in Harlem. Louis Armstrong was playing there, and Mom was crazy about him. We were crossing 7th Avenue when a cat I knew hollered at me. "Girl," he said, "come here. Jimmy's got the best panatella you ever smoked in your life." I tried to brush him off, but he wouldn't brush. I tried to shove him away like I'd never seen him before, and at the same time give him a sign to shut up. I wasn't alone. He kept right on. "That's all right," he said. "Who's she? Your sister? Bring her along, too. There'll be blue lights and red lights, and we'll pitch a ball." Mom knew about reefers, but she didn't know I'd been smoking them for a year. She flipped. "You get out of here," she told our friend. "If you don't, I'm going to put her away until she's 21 and you in jail." There we have it. All right, play one more track. This now we're going to be from, we're just crossing into the year 1936, from January 30th, 1936. This song is Teddy Wilson and his orchestra again, and the track is called "Life Begins When You're in Love." By the way, let me remind you that you're listening to WHPC 90.3, WHPC, WHPC HD, Garden City, New York. I got to get that right. I had it backwards. And of course, the show is How Music Changed, a version of American Hit Radio, which we do on Wednesdays. And we do this every Wednesday and Friday between 5 and 6. We're in the beginning of our series on Billie Holiday. I never know how many parts it's going to take because I really just don't. Well, I know how far I'm going to go. I'm going to go through her entire career. Just a matter of how. I'm not in any rush because I'm loving this. This is like it's like basking in something that I know is just covered in. It's just beautiful for me. So I'm going to enjoy this if you don't mind. All right, let's pick up where we left off then. The first time Pop heard me sing as the main attraction in a Harlem joint, it turned out into a big scene too. Mom was there that night, sitting at another table. She never drank a drop, but this night she broke her rule. I guess she always resented people jumping to the conclusion that my musical talent all came from the Holiday side of the family. Duke Ellington had just written Solitude along about then, and after three drinks, Mom stood up in this joint on 139th Street, said something about Billy not being the only star in the family, and then started singing Solitude in her tinny high baby voice. She sounded like Butterfly McQueen singing out of a register, but she stuck it out for one whole chorus until the whole joint was listening, even Pop. Pop had been sitting across the room with his new wife, Fanny, but after Mom did this number, he came over and sat down with Mom. Mom smiled at him like he was the only man in the world, and Pop was very nice. Eleanor is going to be a big star in show business, isn't she? Said Pop to Mom. Mom beamed with pride and love all mixed up together. She's a big star already, she said. All right, let's play one more track then. It's a bit of a gap when that last track was from January of 1936. This is actually from June 30th, to be exact, 1936. Still Teddy Wilson and his orchestra. This is called It's Like Reaching for the Moon. It's like reaching for the moon. All right. In those days, everything that happened, happened at a jam session somewhere. I'll never forget the night that Benny Goodman brought a skinny young cat uptown with him by the name of Harry James. It was one of the nights almost everybody was on deck. Roy Eldridge, Charlie Shavers, Lester Young, Benny Webster. James was pretty hostile at first, as I remember him. He came from Texas, where Negroes are looked on like they're dirt. It showed. We had to break him out of that, and also of the idea that he was the world's greatest trumpet player. Buck Clayton, whom I thought was the prettiest man I'd ever seen, was a big help. He blew him out with his horn. Of all the cats around, Buck played a style that was sweeter than the others and closer to the thing Harry James was trying to do. It only took a few earfuls of Buck Clayton's playing, and Harry wasn't so uppity. He'd had his lesson, and after that, he came up to jam and loved it. We can play, let's see, we just played I Cried For You. Is that right? Am I getting myself mixed up with my timing here? Oh, no, we did not. I've got to... We played It's Reaching For The Moon just now. So this is track... Yeah, wow. Okay. This is one of the most classic songs that Billy ever recorded. Listen in the beginning. Teddy Wilson opening up with the piano and trading off a little bit with Harry Carney on baritone sax before Billie Holiday starts to sing, or a song that became her first gigantic hit, These Foolish Things.
Thank you.
These Foolish Things. Billie's finally getting some hit recordings there. Back to her words, though, on the book. It was at one of those sessions that I first met Lester Young. From then on, Lester knew how I used to love to have him come around and blow pretty solos behind me. So whenever he could, he'd come by the joints where I was singing to hear me or sit in. I'll never forget the night that Lester took on Chu Berry, who was considered the greatest in those days. Cab Calloway's was the biggest band, and Chu Berry's was one of its big sounds. Well, this night, Benny Carter was jamming for a session with Bobby Henderson, my accompanist. And then there was Lester, with his little old saxophone held together with adhesive tape and rubber bands. Chu was sitting there, and everybody started arguing as to who could blow out whom, trying to promote a competition between Lester and Chu. Benny Carter knew Lester could shine in this sort of duel, but for everybody else, the end of the story was considered a pushover. Chu was supposed to blow Lester right out of the place. Chu had this big, pretty gold horn, but he didn't have it with him. Benny Carter wouldn't let that stop him. He was like me. He had faith in Lester, so he volunteered to go and pick up Chu's horn. He did, and he came back. And then Chu Berry made the same mistake Sarah Vaughan was later going to make with me. He suggested that they do I Got Rhythm, just the way that Sarah had once suggested I Cried for You. Anything but that. I Cried was my damn meat, just like Rhythm was Lester's. He blew at least 15 pretty choruses, none of them the same, and each one prettier than the last. When the 15th one was down, Chu Berry was finished, just like Sarah was finished with my eighth chorus of Cried. Chu's gang were diehards, and they were sick. All they could say to console themselves was that Chu had a bigger tone. What the hell that meant, I'll never know. What difference how big a tone is or how small, as long as Lester's line was moving in that wonderful way with those chords, changes in those notes that would positively flip you with surprise. Chu was a mature man with a great big growl. Lester was a young man. There ain't no rule saying everybody's got to deliver the same damn volume or tone. Well, she mentioned that Sarah once tried to put her over on a song called I Cried for You. Here is Billie Holiday's version of that exact song.
Thank you.
There's that classic arrangement style that I was talking about. That was the song that became her biggest hit, by the way, at first. I Cried for You. It made a big difference, and it started making the labels think that maybe they could give Billie her own band at this point in time, because so far she was just a vocalist appearing on somebody else's credit. All these songs, as they were coming out, were credited to Teddy Wilson and his orchestra. That's how they were. If you bought the record, that's what you would see. Anyway, back to Billie Holiday's words. Everyone's got to be different. You can't copy anybody and end up with anything. If you copy, it means you're working without any real feeling. And without feeling, whatever you do amounts to nothing. No two people on earth are alike, and it's got to be that way in music, or it isn't music. One night, Hal West, the drummer who worked in a trio with Lester, was putting some straightener on his hair. That stuff they peddled then would burn you like crazy unless you were careful and had plenty of water to put on after. Well, just as Hal got it on his hair, he turned on the water faucet and nothing happened. His head was burning up as he tried one faucet, then the other, then got nothing but gas. It burned him so he finally had to stick his head in the toilet bowl to stop it. Mom and I doubled up with laughter, hearing Lester tell how dangerous it was for a young man living alone in a New York hotel. And when he said, "Duchess, can I move in with you?" there was only one answer. Mom gave him a room, and he moved in with us. Ours was a big old railroad flat, two flights up with two entrances off the hallway. The front door was my bedroom, with a door opening to the hall and a little room off it we used to call my playroom, where I kept my records and a beat-up old piano. In the back was the living room and Mom's room. In the middle, off the air shaft, were Lester's quarters. It wasn't fancy, but it beat that damn hotel, and for Mom and me, it was wonderful having a gentleman around the house. Lester was always that. Lester was the first to call Mom Duchess, and it turned out to be the title she carried to her grave. Lester and I will probably be buried too, still wearing the names we hung on each other after he came to live with us. Back at the log cabin, the other girls used to try and mock me by calling me Lady, because I thought I was just too damn grand to take the damn customers' money off the tables. But the name Lady stuck long after everybody had forgotten where it had come from. Lester took it and coupled it with the day out of holiday and called me Lady Day. When it came to a name for Lester, I always felt he was the greatest, so his name had to be the greatest. In this country, kings or counts or dukes don't amount to nothing. The greatest man around then was Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he was the president. So I started calling him the president. It got shortened to Prez, but it still means what it was meant to mean, the top man in this country. Ha! So that's where the name came from. Around this time, I mentioned that that last record was a big hit record, and she was on Brunswick Records, as I said, performing under the orchestra's name. In this case, they decided they would put her on the label Vocalion, which would lower the price to 35 cents a disc, but the credit at this point in time would be Billie Holiday and her orchestra. So this song is the first one to come out under that name. Included in the band is Bunny Berrigan on trumpet, Artie Shaw on clarinet, along with Joe Buskin piano, Dick McDonough on guitar, Arthur Pete Peterson on bass, and Cozy Cole on drums. This track was called Did I Remember? Did I remember to tell you I All right, it's a brand new band for Billie Holiday and her orchestra. The only common player is Cozy Cole. He was the drummer on the previous tracks, but this is a totally different band now. And since we've only got a couple more minutes, let's go straight to the last track we're going to play on the same record as did I remember. This is called No Regrets. Join us back next Friday, 5 p.m. We'll see you then, folks. Take care.
No regrets. Although our love affair has gone astray, no regrets. I know I'll always care though you're away. Somehow happy romance ended suddenly. Still in my heart you'll be forever mine. Sweetheart, no matter what you say or do, I know our love will linger when the other love forgets. So I say goodbye with no regret. You say or do, I know our love will linger.